Deuteronomy chapter 25. Remember, as we're being prepared, the children of Israel are being prepared to enter into the promised land. A few more chapters and we'll be done with this whole book. I know we've gone kind of quickly through it, but I just wanted to get you through that before the Lord came back. Of course, he might come back tonight, so that's all right then. But the plan is to, you know, there aren't very many chapters in this book, and we're coming near the end. About another, what, 9 chapters to go, I think. Something like that. It is full of things that you and I can learn. Although sometimes as you're reading through it yourself, maybe you don't feel like that. But as we read through it together and we slow down and we take a look at every verse, you start to think, oh yeah, there's a lot in there I could learn. There are principles that I can live by. And you'll see some of those as we go through. And Moses is reminding the people all these things before they enter in. They're going to go in without him. And so Moses wants to make sure everybody's ready. And so we continue on in Deuteronomy 25. This is what we read to begin with. If there be a controversy between men, they come to the judgment that the judges may judge them. Then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. And it shall be, if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beaten before his face, according to his fault, by a certain number. 40 stripes he may give him, and not exceed, lest, if he should exceed and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. Okay, so you've seen crimes already listed in the book of Deuteronomy that you and I would call capital offenses. In other words, crimes that would deserve the death penalty. You've seen those. Adultery would be one of those, and well, you know, I mean, you can probably remember the list. And those are capital punishment crimes. You're going to be put to death for those crimes. But there are some crimes that you and I, I guess the word you could use if you want is misdemeanor. They are not worthy of being put to death. And so how do you handle those? And God has a way to handle it. When you go into the promised land, God says, here's how I want this handled. For the misdemeanors that require this kind of punishment, but not the death penalty, 40 stripes was the maximum you could receive. Depending upon the seriousness of the crime, you would receive from 1 all the way up to, you could receive 40, but no more. 40 stripes. And the stripes were done, the beatings were, receiving a spanking is what this is. Flogging, if you like, caning, some countries will use the term. The idea is there. It is done publicly in front of the judge, in front of anybody that wants to watch, and you're beaten, whether it's 1 with the whip or whether it's all the way up to 40. Couldn't go more than 40. Now, the Gentiles took another approach and kind of took off of this, and some of the Gentiles would give you 50, sometimes 60. Rome would give you however many they felt like they wanted to give you, especially if they were trying to get a confession out of you. But the Jews, now, though they were allowed to give up to 40, they noticed that 40 could sometimes kill people. If you weren't careful. And so they didn't want to go over the number 40, so they developed 40 minus 1. And so you'll hear the term 39 lashes. You would receive 39 because they, just in case if they miscounted, they wanted to make sure they didn't break any of God. You know, they are so religious. They want to make sure they didn't break any of God's rules. God says no more than 40. Well, they backed it down to 39 in case they miscounted. They wouldn't have broken one of God's laws. So you could be publicly beaten. You know, instead of putting you in a heated or air-conditioned cell for 3 or 4 days, 24 hours till you sobered up, or 48 hours, or 72 hours, or 2 weeks, or 30 days, or 60 days, or 90 days, or even 6 months. Instead of doing that, they would just publicly beat you right there on the spot. Now, it was effective in the land of Israel. Crime was low. You just didn't like being beaten publicly. Plus, it was very painful. And it wasn't a positive in your life. Now, of course, many scholars think that if we did it today, our crime rate would drop. Because, let's face it, if a guy or a couple of guys get drunk and go out and shoot up the town, you just now take them and put them in a tank for 24 hours till they're sober. They go before the judge. He charges them a little bit of a fine and sends them home. But you can imagine the effect of getting 40 lashes with something that's so painful that it could come near killing you. You'd think twice, maybe not. Drunkards are funny people, but I mean, you might think a little bit about. You remember that American kid who got publicly humiliated by being beaten? He's still to this day. I was reading an article just the other day. That kid still thinks that hurt. I thought, I'm amazed. Now, if you'd have just locked him down for 24 hours in an air-conditioned cell where he had email and a computerized library, maybe you haven't effectively helped him in some way. So God says, this is how you're going to handle it. This is how we're going to handle our misdemeanors. If it comes to the point where there needs to be punishment, then here's how you handle it. That's what he says. Now, verse 4, we go on to verse 4. You see, we're learning how to live in the land that God's given us. Verse 4 says, thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn. God here shows compassion on a dumb ox. I like that, because I know who the dumb ox represents. You see, while the ox was working, and that was hard labor, well, as he's pulling or grinding or treading around the grain, well, he's working hard, he's going to get hungry. He would eat from the grain that he was working on, or working, let me put it another way, that he was working in. And the verse, you know, now we just go to a whole other subject after verse 4. But let's not do that a second. Let's stop and think, wow, God even says, when you're working in the promised land, the land that I've given you, when you're there, you're going to use these beasts of burden. Write these down, would you? These beasts of burden, you're going to use them. You're going to overuse them. You writing this down? Are you getting it? Because I'm going to talk about me in a minute. And when they're working as hard as they're working, don't muzzle them. In the Middle East today, you will find that many of the Arabs and those types will use oxen, but they will muzzle those oxen to keep them from eating up some of the proceeds and the profits. But you see, God's children were told, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Because they're working hard. If you want them to continue to work hard, they need the food. They need to be cared for. Okay. Now, that verse should really be familiar to you, especially as Christians, because you've seen it in the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians, Paul writing to the Corinthian church, chapter 9. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 9. He says, it is written in the law of Moses. We're talking now, he's going to quote from Deuteronomy, chapter 25. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox, or the mouth of the ox, that treads out the corn. Now that's a direct quote out of Deuteronomy 25. Then Paul asks a question of the church. He says, does God take care for oxen, or saith he it altogether for our sakes? You understand the question? He said, do you really think that the only thing God is caring about there is the oxen that's working? Or he says, or is he saying it so that we would learn a lesson about something? And then Paul says, yes, he is saying it so that we will, for our sakes. No doubt this is written. Christian, this is for us that was written. That he that plows should plow in hope, And he that threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap of you carnal things? What's Paul talking about? Paul is talking to the Corinthians about supporting him, isn't he? Look at verse 14 of 1 Corinthians 9. Even so, or just in the same way, has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. Once again, what did he just say? Take care of your preacher. That's just what he said. I like that. Man, that's twice in one week. That's how God works, isn't it? In the mouth of two or three witnesses. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. Take care of those who minister full time. Don't forget them. That's why that verse comes in there out of the middle of nowhere and says, you shall not muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn. And Paul says, do you really think God's only concerned about the ox? No, this is for us. He says, no doubt this is written for our sakes also. He that plows should plow in hope. You see, you take a look at missionaries. You take a look at full-time ministers. You take a look at full-time Christian workers. As far as I'm concerned, they ought to be overworked. If they are not, why not? They should be overworked. There is a specific calling on their life. They shouldn't have it easy. Go back and see this wasn't a little donkey, nice little cute thing. This wasn't some nice looking cow. What was it? A dumb ox. A strong, hard-working ox. That's what the ministry is. If you go take a look at the Apostle Paul and you take a look at his life, he didn't take a lot of vacation days. Did he? No, he didn't. And it didn't matter what everybody else did. There's a calling. When there's a calling on your life, the Bible knows nothing of vacation days. I mean, yeah, you take a day here or there. That doesn't work that way in ministry. And I don't know why all these people in ministry want time off. I don't understand it. What'd you go into ministry for? You went in, you know, Paul, 100%. Persecuted the church. He wanted them dead, men, women, and children alike. His name was Saul. And God picked him up by the head, and his feet were still going, and when God turned him around, when he hit, there was dust. He never slowed down. He just went poof and was off in the opposite direction. And never did he slow down the rest of his life. And if you want to see what ministry's all about, if all of you that are thinking about going into ministry, then look at Jesus. He was always on. He had to find a way to get alone to pray. And he did. He prayed all night sometimes. Or he would get up real early in the morning and go out and away all alone. And he would get some time in before people found him. That's what ministry is. It's an ox. It's not some kind of beautiful horse. It's an ox. It's a job. And I think anybody that enters into ministry has to enter in with their eyes wide open. And, you know, we have learned over the years that if you bring someone into ministry and they're married, you have to interview their wife. You have to, or you're making a big mistake. Because one thing that holds men out of ministry, 9 times out of 10, is that woman. Because she wants him home cutting the grass. Or she wants him home, you know, putting up little things to hang on the wall. And a lot of times he ain't got time to go home and do that. And if you got a woman like that, you're going to want to know it. Because if you got a woman like that, God bless her, that's okay. That's not a sin. You don't want him. You can't have him. He won't work in your ministry. He won't work. You haven't got an ox. You got a donkey. Or anything else. I don't think it's a mistake at all. I think that's what ministry is. I think that people don't understand what ministry is, and that's why so many say, oh, I'm called to ministry. Are you really? Are you really called to ministry? Jesus says, you know, what man goes to war without first sitting down saying, all right, I've got an army this size, this king has an army this size. Can we come against him, or should we just try a peace thing? What man begins to build a bridge without first stopping and saying, all right, how much is it going to cost to get this bridge done? Sitting down and counting the cost. You know, in ministry, you're an ox. When you move into ministry, you move into a fishbowl. And I think you all realize that. It's a fishbowl life. Because people see what you drive, what you wear, they see how you do it, and everywhere you swim, they're watching you go there. So when you enter in, you better know what you're getting into. You're taking the job of an ox. But, take care of that ox. That's what we're told to do. Because the ox ministers in the gospel. That ox lives of the gospel. Don't tread the ox. Don't muzzle the ox while he treads out the corn. And he better be treading out that corn or get another ox. Dumb oxes are easy to come by. Now, how about this one? If brethren dwell together, this is verse 5. And one of them die. And have no child. Are you with me now? This is verse 5 I'm reading. The wife of the dead shall not marry outside the family unto a stranger or outside the land. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his own foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that had his shoe loosed. For the rest of your life, you're known as the guy that had his shoe loosed. We've got a screw, those guys got a screw loose. Now back in Israel, he had a shoe loosed. And you think, wow, verses 5 through 10, now what is that all about? Aren't you glad you didn't live there, guys? God is protecting women. I hear a lot about women's rights. I've seen a couple of their lefts, too. See, as a widow, she had no rights. As a widow, that woman could not work. It just didn't work that way. There was no way to earn any living. And she's got no children. So what's going to happen to her? Even though the property is really hers, she's not going to be able to keep it because she can't work it herself. So she's going to starve to death is what she's going to do. And we hear a lot today about women's rights and women. It's all upside down, and notice it's tearing you apart, in case you hadn't noticed. All in the name of rights. We got women now dying of men's disease. You've come a long way. You don't have rights at all. You're a mess. Love you, though. But God cared about these women, and to take care of them, he says, God would guard the rights of the women and protect them. God himself. And so I want to encourage you, ladies, stick with God. Stick with the Lord. And he will take care of your rights. Don't panic. Don't fear. And don't try to take care of your own. You're going to be in trouble. See, if the woman's husband dies, she's in big trouble. There is nothing she can do now but probably starve to death if somebody doesn't do something for her. Because they weren't allowed to work. And if she wasn't real attractive, nobody would want her. And now she's alone and going to die that way. And the property would fall into the hands of possibly a stranger. Because, see, she wasn't allowed to go out and remarry a stranger. So she's left with a piece of land to take care of. She has no children to help. Now she's, who's going to take care of it? Well, here's what, this is cool, ladies. Ready for this? This was the one time when the woman was required to propose. Happens all the time now. But I mean, that's not, that hasn't been so common. The woman, she had to go propose. Interesting thought. She had to go, and she would go and claim one of her husband's brothers. If there were no brothers, she would claim the next of kin or the nearest relative, whether it would be a cousin or a second cousin. Somehow the next of kin, she would go and she would propose. And she was to do the asking, which was probably difficult for her because women weren't so bold in those days. But she had to do the asking. A little embarrassing, but she did it. Have you ever read the book of Ruth? Where Ruth says to Boaz, throw your skirt over me. What's she saying? You got to marry me, dude. I'm asking you to marry me. Naomi says, you got to go there tonight. Watch where he's laying. Lay at his feet when it's real quiet. Don't let nobody know you're there. Everyone's real quiet. And he's going to notice you're there. He's going to move his feet and there's something down there. And he's thinking, what is that? And before he says anything too much, you say, you got to marry me. I'm asking you to marry me. You're next of kin. And so you need to marry me or Naomi and I are going to starve to death. Remember that? And you thought, that's so weird. No, that's according to the law in Deuteronomy. That's just that she's doing just what the law said she ought to do. She hasn't been forward or anything gross at all. Well, you know, after she proposed, Boaz could have said, not on your life. What did Boaz tell her? Can anybody remember? Yeah, there's, you know, I'm not the next, there's one closer than me. You'll need to check with him first. I think you gotta, you know, there's protocol. Not a brother, but closer than I am. Now, what if that brother doesn't want to marry this lady? I mean, that's possible. She comes along and says, all right, your brother died. I don't have any children. I got to get married or I'm going to lose all this. So I'm asking you to marry me. And he goes, no. No, thank you very much. I have one wife or two and that's plenty. And I don't need this. What does it say that she should do? Take him to court. When you go to the gate of the city, that's where the judges were, that's where the elders were, that's where the court was held. She's taking him to court. You go out before the judges, and she would plead her case to the city elders, to the judges, and say, this guy refuses to marry me. I've asked him, and he refuses. He won't do his responsibility. And in front of the judges, they'll ask him, all right, is that true? Are you saying you're not going to marry this girl? If he continues to refuse, there is a penalty. He is disgraced publicly. Why? Because God wants this woman cared for. And if this man is not willing to do it, and it's his responsibility, he is publicly disgraced. She spits in his face and takes off his shoe and hands it to him. And he's known the rest of his life as the one who had his shoe loosed. It's in the papers. You'll see his picture standing there holding his shoe. You know, they caught him just right there. You know, the reason he's disgraced is why. He is not being true to his own brother or to his own family or to his own tribe and in the long run, even to his own country. He's a disgrace. Now, you understand why marriage was such a family affair for the Jews. And should still be for us, but it's not as much as it used to be, but it was a family affair for the Jews. You got to imagine a house where there are three Jewish boys. And one of them keeps sneaking out. He doesn't come back at home till about 10 or 11 every night. And his brothers go, "Where are you going? What are you doing all the time? Where you been? We don't see you much. What are you doing?" Finally, the truth comes out. "I've been seeing this girl. And we're in love and we're talking about getting married." And his brothers would say, "Not on your life until we see her." Why? Yeah, that's exactly right. You're not going to let your brother marry somebody that you wouldn't marry yourself, man. Would you? I wouldn't. Wait a minute, man. If you die, no. No, because if you died in the rest of my life, I'm going to be the one spitting my face at you. No. We don't approve of this one. I mean, when you got married, everybody in your house, your brothers, your cousins, the whole, everybody want to go, "All right, she's okay." Right? That'd be tough. "Not without checking with us first," his brothers would say. Nuh-uh. You notice this was God's way of keeping the families close together. Keeping them close together. That way the land would always stay in the family. It wouldn't be gotten by strangers. Now think about it. Because God set that law up to teach us something about ourselves. Because Ruth showed us how it worked. We read here how to do it. But Ruth showed it to us in action, didn't she? Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. Now, Ruth represented who in that story? The church. Us. And Boaz represented who in the book of Ruth? Jesus. Jesus is our kinsman redeemer. What does it tell you about us? We're helpless. We're hopeless. We have no means of support. We're going to lose it all if someone doesn't come along and help. And Jesus could have said, "There ain't no way I'm taking that one." Couldn't he? Oh yeah, he could have. But he was so full of mercy. He took me and you, didn't he? He is our Goel, our kinsman redeemer. And the law is designed to do what? Take care of the one who had absolutely no hope. To take care of the one who had no way that they could care for themselves. And they would die without someone showing them that kindness. Yo, the law itself was designed to take care of that woman and to make sure that women's rights were upheld and taken care of. But the principle is there to teach you about me and you. We're hopeless. We're helpless without Jesus. And someone told me this week, "I don't believe that." And I just smiled and said, "I don't care. It's true. The truth always remains the truth, whether you and I accept it or not. Doesn't change. Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. He is willing to take us. And you notice, Jesus absorbs our filthiness. And you know that love covers a multitude of sins. I hope you're finding yourself being less judgmental and more willing to accept anyone and everyone. If you're not, then you haven't really looked into this perfect law of liberty enough. We are told that this looking into the Word of God is like looking into a mirror. A man beholding his face in a mirror. You look into that mirror and you see how filthy you are. If you're looking into this mirror and you're seeing that you're a mess, you're certainly going to be thankful that God has washed you clean, and you're going to be more willing to accept everyone else around you, no matter how dirty they might look. True? Isn't it amazing how God sets it up so that we can see His love for every one of us? That's just amazing. Okay, let's move on. Let's see. We got all the way to verse 10. Verse 11 says, when a man strive together with one another and they get into a fight, and the wife of one draws near to deliver her husband. Her husband's losing this fight. They're at fisticuffs. There's a fight. And so deliver her husband out of the hand of him that smites him, and puts forth her hand and takes him by the secrets. Then thou shalt cut off her hand. Thy eye shall not pity her. What are we talking about? That's easy. In case you were wondering. It was intended to preserve the modesty that women ought to have. You got two men fighting, and it was intended to preserve the modesty that women had then, and basically, except for a few of you, have lost today. It's gone. But that's what it's there for, intended to preserve that. I mean, to cut off someone's hand. You know, the Israelites were not into maiming their bodies, like many other of the people at that time. They would do strange things. If a man kissed a woman and she didn't want him to, they would cut his lips off. You know, if he would try to do something to steal and run away, they would cut his feet off. Israel wasn't into that kind of thing. Israel wasn't a maybe. They would usually get a beating or they would somehow. But in this particular case, they cut a woman's hand off. Why? To preserve what? Modesty. Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. How important that must be to God that women be modest. We're losing it. And that's simply what that's in there for, I'm sure. Now, verse 13. Is that what I want? Yes. You shall not have in your bag, carrying in your purse, or in your backpack, diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure shalt thou have. That thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God gives thee. For all that do such things and all that do unrighteously are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. Right there, verses 13 through 16, simply telling us, and we've seen it all through the book of Proverbs. If you've studied through Proverbs, you see it. Simply telling us, we must be completely honest in our dealings with people. We're Christians. We're God's children. We need to be completely honest in everything that we do. Whether we're selling each other a pig or some cattle, or whether we're trading each other clothing for food, whatever kind of business we do, whatever kind of things we do as a business and as well as in dealing with each other, God wants us to be completely honest all the time. In everything that we do. That's very clear. Complete honesty is God's whole idea. That's what he wants from us. That's what he's saying here. He says, you shall have a perfect and just weight, verse 15. A perfect and just measure you shall have, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God gives you. For all that do such things, cheaters, and all that do unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God. God hates it if you and I would cheat each other in business dealing. So we try not to do that. Sometimes there are misunderstandings. You try to avoid misunderstandings, but they happen. They can happen between Christians too. That's not a sin. That's just, you know, something that we need to learn how to work out. But we should never cheat or knowingly cheat each other. We should be honest in business. If you're a Christian business man, Christian business woman, you should be known for your honesty. The word should be out. They're Christians. You can trust them. It shouldn't be, oh yeah, they got a little fish on their business card, but the truth is they ripped us off last year. And you know, I just have some friends at home who were buying and selling a home. And so they bought and sold a home through friends of theirs at the same church. And the friends of theirs stole money from them. And so they emailed and they said, we don't know how do we deal with this? What do we do? There are brothers and sisters in the Lord and they have obviously cheated us. We know they have. And we don't know how to deal with it. Well, you know, the Bible tells you how to deal with that. But the point is, that shouldn't be me and you. We shouldn't do that to one another. It shouldn't be. We should be forgiving of one another. We should be honest completely in all our ways. Because God hates it otherwise. Now, verse 17. Is that what I want? Yes, I do. I want verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you were come forth out of Egypt. That's interesting. God says specifically, I want you to remember what was done to you by Amalek when you guys came out of Egypt, while you were in the wilderness. I want you to remember it. How he met you by the way and smote the hindmost of you, even all that were feeble and behind thee, when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, or because of that, it shall be when the Lord thy God has given thee rest from all thine enemies round about in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that you shall blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget it. That's an interesting statement. Israel was attacked by the Amalekites, by Amalek. And it was, remember, as they were coming out of Egypt, and they had been out of Egypt just a short time, and there were millions of them, some say maybe 3.5 million people. And the Amalekites sneaked up on them, unprovoked, and they attacked the rear of Israel, the rear echelon, where the elderly, the weak, and the sick people were, who couldn't quite stay up with everyone, so they held back a little and they were moving at a slower pace. They weren't being left. They were just the end of the trail. And the Amalekites came up and began to kill them and to take things that they had. Unprovoked, out of nowhere. And that made God angry. God said, I'll never forget that, never. And as you've studied through the books of Genesis, as you study through Exodus, is where we're talking about Exodus, and on. Do you remember what the Amalekites or what Amalek represents in your life today? This is a test for those of you that have been through. Right. Good. Your flesh. Self, right? They're a type of the flesh. By the way, there was a battle because they attacked the elderly and those that were weaker, and those that were sick, and they put many of them to death. A battle ensued. Remember that battle? That was a battle where Moses climbed up on a hill and began to lift his arms in prayer. Remember that? And as he would hold up that rod, and as Moses was over 80 years old, and was kind of tired, and it was hard to hold his arms up, and when his arms would come down, the Amalekites would start to win. And so in prayer, with his arms holding that rod up, when the rod was straight up in the air, Israel was winning. So do you remember that Aaron and the man called Hur, H-U-R, they came up and on either side of Moses, they held up his arms. They put a rock under him so he could sit down, and they held his arms up so that Israel could win the fight. And of course, representing the prayer that was going on. And that was a fight against what? The flesh. Have you ever read Galatians chapter 5, verse 17? For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. These are contrary to one to the other, so that you cannot do the things that you would. Listen to Exodus chapter 17. I'm going to read verses 14 through 16. Listen closely. Exodus 17, verses 14 through 16. Listen to this. The Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. Say it out loud to Joshua. For I will utterly put out of the, utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. Why? Because he said, the Lord has sworn, listen closely, that the Lord will war with Amalek from generation to generation. There will be a continual fight. And God is showing us, now we're His. Now we belong to Him. Yet, there's a spiritual battle going on. There is a war going on right now in your life between your flesh and between spirit. It will always go on until the day you were taken out of this body. And the Lord's not going to forget it. By the way, Amalek. God said, when you're in the land and everything's going pretty good, we're going to wipe out the Amalekites. And who did he send to do it? Can anybody remember? Saul. Remember that? And did Saul do it? He disobeyed the Lord. He let some of them live. Who killed Saul, or at least who tried to kill Saul? One of the Amalekites. Isn't that interesting? After all those years, when God told him to do something, God tells us that we should reckon the old man, the old flesh, dead. Now, remember, we learned in an earlier chapter, you're not going to be brutal with your body. You're not going to start beating yourself, poking pins through your heads, nailing yourself to the cross or whatever. We're not going to do that to ourselves. What do? We reckon the old man, this old nature, this flesh, dead. Galatians 2:20, I'm crucified with Christ. That's how we live. That's how we think. But the battle rages, and the battle will never stop until we leave these bodies. And that's what you're seeing here. God's reminding us of these things as they enter into the promise. Realize that there's a battle that will go on in your life. Spirit and the flesh. And those that have the most trouble are the ones that refuse to acknowledge that there's a battle going on. That's usually when you have the most trouble. We've got to acknowledge that my flesh is capable of doing messy things. And I need to reckon the old man dead, put it to death. And each day when you get up, we need to put on the armor of God. And we need to fight the good fight of faith. I know you remember all these things. God takes care of every one of us as individuals. He takes care of the rights of those who can't defend themselves or take care of themselves. God loves you. He has made every provision for your safety, for your welfare, for your life forever. The answer is in Jesus Christ. It's not in figuring out what your problems are and finding a psychiatrist that can help you deal with them. It is in turning your life over to the Lord. Turning over every bit of you to God. Opening your heart. None of this, I'm mad at God this week. That is unwise. You just can't, those kinds of things don't come out of believers. When they do, that believer's out of their head. They're not thinking right. No, you're not mad at God. No, God is the one that saved your life. God is the one that loved you so much that you're still breathing right now. God's holding your next breath. No, that's not the one to be mad at. If you want to use your head logically, stop and back up. And if there's somebody you're going to get mad at, not God. He's the one who's in control. He's the one who can help. You don't spit at him and then start telling him you need help. As I've said it to you a few times. I mentioned it last night in the Revelation class. Your arms are too short to box with God. Quit trying to fight with the Lord who is here to love you. He is here that you can have life. Jesus Christ died on the cross that he would pay the price. He paid the price for sins that you might have life and have life abundantly. So as you read through even this Old Testament, you say, I'll read this, it doesn't make sense. Read it slowly. Slow down. Take a look and see what God's saying. If you don't understand it, read it again. If you don't understand it then, read it again. Keep going until he comes back to get you. Stay in the Word. Trust Him. Listen to the Lord. He loves you. And He's there to defend you and to protect you every step of the way. He has taken care of you. You've been given eternal life, those of you that are Christians. Don't plan to go out and disobey Him. So those of you that are living in sin, stop it. Ask the Lord for the strength to allow you to stop it. And don't go any further into the hole. What's the first rule about being in a hole? The best way to get out of a hole is to first what? Stop digging. And God will get you out of that hole. Quit digging, everybody. Listen to the Lord. Let's bow our heads.